I believe we were on the subject of the control of the imagination. Am I correct?
Yes.
Which, to be exact, is the third part of section 11 of our, you might say, topical index for the course. We began by noting that by imagination we mean the interior faculty of reproducing any past experience. Thus, the experience may be in the intellect, then we call it the intellectual imagination, or it may be in the senses, and then it is the sense or sensible imagination. Commonly, but incorrectly, the imagination is identified with the image-making faculty, corresponding to the sense of sight, which can be reproduced interiorly, and then we call it imagination. But philosophically speaking, the imagination is the interior faculty of reproducing any past cognitive experience. Any past cognitive experience can be reproduced interiorly. The value, that's the second thing we want to look at, the value of the imagination. It is an indispensable faculty on which, for example, our whole life of prayer depends. In fact, the spiritual life depends on a well-cultivated, and I would add, a well-controlled imagination. We must interiorly recall our past experiences for them to have any value in the present. I meet a person in the corridor, I must remember she's my superior. If I forget that, evidently there can be problems. The value of the imagination can be summarized on four levels, especially for the spiritual life. For prayer, the master of the spiritual life who has made most of the use of the imagination in prayer, he is Saint Ignatius, as you may recall from reading or making the spiritual exercises. Secondly, the imagination is indispensable for planning. We can hardly be set to plan into the future unless we somehow draw on the past. Drawing on the past is, in essence, reproducing the past for present need. I recall what happened. I recall some data, information, experience, and then on that I build, for example, to plan for tomorrow. I must know what I've achieved today. My intellectual imagination and other forms of that same faculty must tell me how far I've come. Otherwise, I'd be repeating and repeating and never progressing. Third, the imagination is indispensable for the communication of ideas. Thus, for example, we must have retained in our intellectual imagination, otherwise known as the memory, the alphabet, or the relation of certain ideas with certain words, which when used, we assume we will communicate to someone else what is already in our minds. In other words, the whole practice of charity in the communication of ideas. depends on the imagination. And finally, the imagination requires a great deal of self-control. In fact, I would almost identify self-control with imagination control. If you can control your imagination, you can, I assure you, control everything else. As I would also have to say, if you cannot control your imagination, everything else gets out of control. In other words, it is the most fertile field for the practice of sacrifice, the sacrifice of past pleasant experiences which happen to be sinful. Unless I can control my experience from the past, which was sinful, I will never avoid sin in the future. So much for the value. I might insert for just a moment that the imagination which we now have in common with the rest of our human nature is, as strange as the words may sound, a fallen imagination. Our whole nature is fallen, or as I prefer to say, our whole nature is falling. There is a constant lean, either backward or forward, but to fall over in all our human powers, and not only, be it said, in the flesh or the body. Human nature fell, not just the body. The soul fell. The human spirit is a fallen spirit with tendencies due to original sin that, as we know from experience, can lead us into all kinds of sin. Now, the need of control. I have some 6 areas, and they're just a fraction of the total of the ways in which we should work at controlling our imagination. Why? First, because it is the source of so much loss of time. I happen to be from Cleveland, and I just remember once on a large billboard in downtown Cleveland was a huge sign giving the figures that could be seen from the street on the number of books of various kind that had been borrowed from the Cleveland Public Library System during the past fiscal year. I remember there were something like 9 million borrowings of books in the given year in the city of Cleveland, a city of about, at that time, 700,000 people, which would average about, say, 10 or 12 books a year per man, woman, and child. But what I didn't forget was that, say, out of those 8 million books borrowed from the Cleveland library system, almost 7 million, 7/8, were fiction books. I've never forgotten that figure. That about 90% of all the books borrowed in this one city, and I guess the figures could be duplicated elsewhere, only 1 out of 10 books has to do with anything that is objectively real or substantive. All the rest, 90%, I think this is a safe figure, 90% of all the books read in the United States are food for the imagination. So it's a waste of time. I see a 600 or 700 or even larger number page book, or I see the people pouring, for example, even through the New York Times. By the way, I read enough of the New York Times to say this. Easily 95% of it is fiction. Just not real. So first, lack of control of the imagination is a terrible loss of time. We are to use the mind to think. To think reality. And we used to use the will to choose what is good, what is objectively good. The only reason that people sin is because their imagination colors whatever they are tempted to do as something apparently good, and it's not. Sinning is choosing the unreal good. Again, and this in terms of training people, make sure they know early how valuable is control of the imagination. I dare say nobody, unless they were either not in the use of their senses or totally perverse, would think of wanting to become religious unless they had already acquired some control of the imagination. Secondly, lack of control is a terrible waste of energy. Not only a waste of time, but waste of energy. A lot of people, I think, drain themselves psychologically because they don't control their imaginations. Their minds, when I teach Buddhists, I quote this figure of speech. The Buddhists describe the human mind as a monkey in a cage. A little crude, but not bad. The cage being the skull, and the mind being the monkey that keeps jumping through to and fro. People are dead tired. Not because they've done so much thinking, but because they haven't. So a waste of energy. And frankly, energy being thus wasted is often made incapable of serious, concentrated work. Third, the imagination is the principal source of temptation. Biblically, we speak of the three sources of temptation as the world, the flesh, and the devil. Well, the world works on our imagination. The glamorous sinners on television and in magazines. We want to imitate them. The flesh. We'd never be tempted, or at least not seriously, if along with the urge to do something wrong, at the same time we were fully conscious of the consequences. And the devil, this, by the way, I think bears a little extra emphasis. The evil spirit, unlike the good spirit, whether the divine good spirit or the good spirits, the angels, the evil spirit is not permitted by God to directly enter the mind and will of a human being. But the devil is allowed to work on our imagination, and he does. We'll always picture imagination as something which he wants us to do as appealing, attractive, sweet, tasty, pleasant, satisfying. The devil would be out of his demonic mind if he didn't tempt us by working on our imagination and never presenting what is sinful as really bad. All temptations are sweet, no exceptions. All temptations are pleasant, no exceptions. All temptations are attractive, no exceptions. And the devil knows it. He didn't tell Eve when he tempted her in Eden what the consequences were going to be. He wouldn't dare. Remember the fruit? Whatever the symbolism means, it was pleasant. And Eve made the mistake of, under the devil's instigation, looking too long. So it's the source, the psychological source of all temptation. I might mention, without dwelling on this, that the source of all our thinking is, as human beings, from the imagination. We have sense experience from outside of us, then imagination, which is internal experience inside of us, and then from that internal imagination, thoughts are, as we say, abstracted. Abstraction is simply the power we have of abstracting from the particularities of an experience and drawing out some general, as we call it, idea. The abstraction makes it an idea. There are four steps to every action. Step number one, sense experience from the outside. Step number two, the imagination, which is the internal reliving, reproducing of the internal experience. Third, abstraction, thought, which derives from the imagination. No imagination, no thought. And fourth, desire. No thought, no desire. Once more. No sensation, no imagination. No imagination, no thought. No thought, no desire. What you see, the imagination is a key stage in that process of desiring. Fourth, the need of control. Otherwise, our spiritual life becomes uncontrollably distracted. Recollection of spirit, of which all the spiritual masters talk, is in essence control of the imagination, because knowing by now that certain images, used in the very broad sense of covering every internal reproduction, that certain past experiences should be sustained and others should be let go. And the one past experience that, if we wish to remain recollected, that we must sustain is, well, the thought of God, the experience of God. Either I strive to recall the past experience of God, or I will not now be praying. So the fourth reason why there is need for control is not to distract ourselves spiritually. Our minds will be filled with all kinds of secular experiences unless we control the imagination. And when people enter the religious life, I know because time was when I entered, I remember after about 2 months, my past experiences began to flow over me. And I thought of the pleasant things that I used to have, as I said, outside. And I began to pity myself. Woe is me. I looked at the four walls, looked at the desk in front of me, and I thought to myself, why did you do it? So I wrote to the priest who really got me in, and I told him how homesick I felt, left a widow and mother behind, friends, all kinds of wonderful things, and here I am. Well, I've never got such a blistering letter from any priest. You so-and-so, stop thinking those thoughts. And if a person is even going to persevere in the religious life, they've got to stop thinking about their past experience, because as Christ himself tells us, we go in the direction of that which we love, and we love that which is in our minds and on our hearts. If you don't want to love the world, keep the world out of your imagination. Makes sense, doesn't it? And nobody, not even the good God, will save a vocation where the person does not control their imagination. Now, of course, there must be enough pleasant things in the religious life to appeal and attract, and as it were, compete with other attractions which keep rising in the imagination. Part of perseverance in the religious life is starving the secular imagination. The vocabulary may be a bit strange, but I trust you know what I'm trying to say. Fifth need for control. There is nothing that more constantly and sadly interferes with prayer than an uncontrolled imagination. What are distractions in prayer except the imagination activated by thoughts and desires that have nothing to do with the prayer? finally, the lack of control of the imagination weakens self-discipline in every aspect of human life. There is no possibility of controlling any other faculty unless the imagination is controlled. Now, a bit of experience that took me 30 years in the priesthood to learn. You'd never guess this. The men in class, that's we 3, 4, 5, 6 of us. I guess men think that women have the more active imagination. That is not true. Did you know that? Who writes the poetry? There just couldn't be a Mrs. Shakespeare. Most of the poetry, or there are a few exceptions, but they are exceptions. Most of the poetry of the world, and that's from the dawn, I'm not sure how far back it goes, of history. Most of the poetry has been written by men. Scientific theories all begin in the imagination. I repeat, it took me 30 years to learn this. One reason, I suppose, that I deal so much with religious women, having lived with a widowed mother till I left to join the order at the age of 22, I think I know the heart of a woman. Women are the realists. Men are the dreamers. Honest. I remember 4 couples at Mass. Every day I promise them to try to save the marriages. And in each case, the man is unwilling, as a husband, to work with a wife who has her feet on the ground. At any rate, we all need to control the imagination. It is much more active in men. But, and this too I say, sadly, I think many women religious have been misled in the church today by speculative men theologians. When I read men like Hans Kuhn, or Raymond Brown, or Richard McBrien, I call it, because it is, theological fiction. Really. So women can be misled. Self-discipline begins with controlling the imagination. Now, the method of control. I don't think I need to apologize for the length of time we're spending on this blessed imagination. Let me tell you, it is, I think, worth it. I've got 8 suggestions for controlling the imagination. And I stopped at 8 because I reached the bottom of the page. First, if we ourselves, or in favor of others, want to control the imagination, The first place to begin is being convinced how important control here is. This is not child's play. It's not easy. No adjective I can use would be too strong. It is of consummate importance. Note, I wish to repeat, this is not the suppression of the imagination. It can't be. Life would stop. It is not denying the imagination. It is not suppressing the imagination. It's controlling it. First then, being convinced of the importance of imagination control. Second, recognize how dangerous is an uncontrolled imagination. Reread the Gospels in this light, and you will be surprised what insight you will gain from some of the teaching of Christ. What does Christ tell us? Where does all sin begin? In the heart. In his Sermon on the Mount, you've been told you will not commit adultery, but I tell you, if a man even looks lustfully at a woman, he's already committed adultery with her in his heart, in the imagination. We are not only not to do, say, physical or bodily injury to another person. We are not even to think. Notice, we must control our interior imagination in not thinking unkindly. I don't know how many times I've told people, you have a sharp tongue, an asp's tongue. But unlike an asp, you have a free will. You either control your unkind thoughts, or you will never control your unkind speech. Therefore, recognize, and the connection must be made by the person himself, to see the relationship between control of those inside images, fancies, and their expression. Third, act immediately once you recognize that a dangerous memory or image occurs inside of my mind. Immediately change it to a good one. And by the way, that's the formula. The formula is not get rid of the evil image or evil memory. You don't get rid of evil images or evil memories except by substituting good ones. And that is not a trivial piece of advice. Fourth, plan your actions. And part of the planning, of course, is that I plant in my memory, in my mind, in my imagination. Otherwise, it will never carry into act what I've decided to do. I've got to prime myself. I've got to, as it were, work myself up. Plan your actions. Fifth, get going. Depending on the nature of what's on my imagination, and I repeat and keep repeating, it is not only the picture-making faculty. The imagination covers all kinds of past experiences that are somehow reproduced. The secret of achievement is get going. I give my students some work to do, and they come back with just a trickle of what I've expected them to do in the time at their disposal. And often, if they're honest, they tell me, it took me so long to get started. The desk hasn't been dusted for 2 weeks. They've got work to do. They suddenly notice the dust on the desk. Now, it's a good thing to dust the desk and to straighten things out. But by the time I've done those physical chores, half my, say, speaking as a teacher, study time is gone. Get going. Sixth, concentrate on what you are doing. I don't think, there is a more important recommendation in the spiritual life than the following. There may be others as important, but I know of none more important. Let me give you the Latin and put it on the board. Which being translated means, do what you're doing. Which is a pathetic admission that unless we make a strong effort to do what we're doing, we will allow our imagination to interfere with what we're doing and to both do what we're doing and do what we shouldn't be doing. Age quod agis. One of the first things we learned in the novitiate. One of Ignatius' favorite adages. It's an adage that I think we can all both learn for ourselves and insist that others follow. Concentrate. I was lecturing at Trinity College last week on, of all things, Buddhism. Well, they asked me to, and I know a few things about Buddhism, so they listened. And I told them, as I must have told some of you in class somewhere along the line, I've taught Orientals over the years, Jesuits from Asia. I have found them as a class far superior as a class to Western students, intellectually superior. And one reason, after years of teaching them and talking to them and learning about their culture, one thing I've learned. In the Orient, because there is so much less preoccupation with material things, the mind is more concentrated in what it's doing. That's why I'm told by people in New York that the Japanese are far ahead of us in economy, in production. They are, I'm told, years ahead of us in the scientific manufacture of machinery, like the automobile. They concentrate. I've been told by any number of people in administration, in business, or industry, The hardest thing to get out of a person these days is 8 hours of honest work a day. They've got to take a break for this and a break for that. They don't concentrate. They don't do what they're doing. Until in the West, we have coined this cynical definition of work. Work is that which a man would rather not be doing if he could be doing something else. And I think that goes not only for physical work, but for prayer, for intellectual effort, for you name it. In any case, we are the most imagination-ridden society in history. The Easterners describe Western society as a dream world. Can't wait until they get home from work. So what do? Turn on the television set. An average in the United States now, man, woman, and child, 20 hours a week of viewing television. In the meantime, the real world is collapsing around us. So concentrate on what you're doing. Number 7. Since we're talking to religious and about religious life and how to help those who have entered religious life maintain their spirit and grow indeed in the spiritual life, I recommend number 7, cultivate sacred memories. I believe one of the most neglected faculties in the Western world is the memory. Now this should be part of the training, I think, from the early days in the religious life. For example, certain prayers simply must be memorized. Scripture. There are some 24 Muslim religious orders, just for the record, in the world. A number of them require as a condition for the persons taking their vows, and they take vows, that they listen, that they have memorized the Quran. Now the Quran is not quite as big as our Bible, but it's a pretty big book. When I started teaching the Missionaries of Charity in New York, I think I've told you this, from almost our first day of class, and this is now 4 years, I required of them to memorize passages from the New Testament. At first it was every week about 10 or 12 verses. They complained to the superior. She complained to me. She said, "Father, this is wonderful, but I think it's getting to the sisters. Could we cut it down?" So now we have it every 2 weeks. And it's usually not 10 or 12, it's closer to 6 or 7 verses. But then, after 2 weeks, it used to be for 2 years every week, they all know they have uniform little pads which they distribute among all the sisters, and we say our opening prayer, and then they write out the memory. We are now, because Mother Teresa asked me to teach her sisters, for a whole year, the theology of the Sacred Heart. 2.5 hours a week for 48 weeks. That's a lot of theology of the Sacred Heart. It's good for me too. So we're starting, we began in September, we're starting with the four chapters of Christ's sermon at the Last Supper. And we're pretty well finished with the first chapter. And they tell me, this is the contemplative branch of the Missionaries of Charity, they tell me it is simply indispensable. They just cannot imagine, pardon the word, they cannot imagine what their spiritual life would be unless they had their memories filled with the words of Christ. Doesn't that make sense? We've got everybody else's words in mind except those of the Master.
I was going to suggest, Father, I do know a community of Cistercian monks that actually, I would say 90% of them know the Psalms by heart. All the Psalms by
this,
heart.
This, I want to, there are a certain number of things in the practical order that I can recommend and urge with all my heart. I would urge this with all my heart. I've taught for too many years. I know that for most people, intelligent people, their memories are simply uncultivated. Grown men and women with the memories of a six-year-older and the result, there are many results, but one result is they cannot draw on things which are within them when they need them. We think with the mind we've got. The mind which we come into the world with is a blank. Memory furnishes that mind with sacred things to think about. The same with saints. For years I used to do this. Now I'm, you might say, capitalizing on the past experience. I think I told you I try to read from the life of the saint every day. I have a good life of the saint over the rectory there, and pardon me for saying this, sometime I start reading it when I come back at night, and I wake up at 2 a.m. with the life of the saint on the floor next to me. But for years in reading the lives of the saints, I would cull favorite passages from them. There is nothing that more surely cements a past mental experience than writing it out. I could talk for the rest of the day about memorized passages from the saints. And finally, nourish holy images. This means, as we said at the beginning, and this is our last recommendation, since everything begins outside the mind, and since my imagination will be no better or worse, no more secular or sacred, than what comes in from outside the mind, make sure that those images are nourished by sacred things outside, sacred pictures, statues, spiritual reading. Constantly long pause, remind yourself of things sacred. One of the principal functions of the religious habit. The imagination, and this is no exaggeration, he is affected by how we're dressed. If you're dressed like a secular, you're going to think like a secular, you're going to have the imagination of a secular. You dress like a religious, you're going to think like a religious, you're going to have the imagination of a religious. That's why when people tell you that the habit doesn't make any difference, well, I tell them, it probably doesn't make any difference to you anymore, because how people dress reveals how they think. Secular dress is the proof positive symbol of a secular mind. And with that, I think we should stop with the control of the imagination. Otherwise, I would not be living up to my own recommendations. Are there any questions? And by the way, we didn't take a break. Nobody seems to be fagged out. Look, we only have half an hour to go. You want to take a break? Why? Okay. The next item on our agenda, beginning with section 12, is the aggressive personality. I have this in four stages. First, I want to talk about personality in general, then the specific meaning or description of an aggressive personality, then third, the analysis of that kind of a person, and fourth, how do you deal with them? First then, personality. I would define personality as the distinctive qualities of a human being as an individual And of course, we are all different. However, I think it is worthwhile, especially since we're addressing ourselves to formation, I think it is well to distinguish, as I've had to distinguish in dealing with people, between personality properly so-called as we've just defined it, and character. Many writers just don't distinguish between character and personality. They are not the same. Unlike personality, properly so-called, character is the personality of an individual. It is that, but it's personality plus. Character, then, is the personality of an individual as this individual has developed through experience and moral behavior since infancy to one's present age. Let me repeat. Personality differs from character, which is the personality of an individual, comma, as this has developed, that is the personality, through experience and moral behavior since infancy to one's present age. In dealing with people, especially those whom you've never known before, I cannot tell you how valuable this distinction is. Because personality, properly so-called, is something we are, I don't say born with, we're conceived with. It has been nothing less than defined by the church because a heresy rose to the contrary, that God creates a distinctive soul, note, distinctive soul, for each person at the moment of conception. So the differences and varieties among persons come from God. Isn't that good to hear? Because He creates the spirit. And no two spirits that infuse or are infused into the human body at conception, even in otherwise identical twins, are the same. So personality is that which is God-given. Character is that which is man-made. Whereby man-made, I mean the personality which is already different, which then is differently shaped by my experiences. No two people have the same experience, and surely no two people during their lives have behaved in the same way. Brother?
So, Father, then a person cannot change his personality? But
strictly speaking, no.
But he may change his character?
Yes. And the character is meant to change.
With the change of character, would that could more or less not change the personality, but give certainly a different indication of a personality a person may have. For instance, I might be naturally aggressive, but my character may portray itself as gentle and kind.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in dealing with people, it is very important to distinguish between the two. Otherwise, I may, for example, as one in charge of those under my care, I may make the mistake of trying to reshape a personality, whereas I should be reshaping a character. Now, that's not a cheap distinction. And it's my responsibility to find out what is distinctive, and therefore God-given, about this personality. And there are some things that after years of experience, well, you cannot really remove because they're too much part of the personality. But they can at least be improved if they cannot be removed. So we're dealing with a very critical subject here. Now the analysis, specifically, oh pardon me, meaning, and this is very short. What do I mean by aggressive personality? An aggressive personality is one that instinctively tries to command others and to have its own way. An aggressive personality is one that instinctively tries to command others and to have its own way. Now this is my own homemade definition, but this is part of my job, is to make up homemade definitions as we go along. And now, three, the analysis. First, when we speak of aggressive personality, it is partly personality, partly character. In other words, by the time a person enters our lives, he or she has had a lot of experience and has engaged in many acts of moral, that is, free human behavior. So the aggressiveness is not all just sheer personality. It may be partly the result of character. You may not appreciate the development, but there it is. And some people, for example, have had to struggle. There's such a thing as struggling for survival. And these are things that I should know. Because the person is just, you might say, flexing its moral muscles because it had to in order to stay, for example, morally alive. I have found, by the way, there are some but not many exceptions, sisters in communities that have secularized. I have found, with few exceptions, they tend to have an aggressive personality. That is, sisters who have survived in secularized institutes. Does that make sense? Because either you develop whatever aggressiveness you have, or by now you would become, well, part of the landscape or the wallpaper, like everybody else. Number two, the aggressive personality is rooted in human nature as human, but also is shaped by original sin. So that the aggressiveness is partly a human quality, which we need to have otherwise, unless a person, for example, was hungry and aggressively sought food, they would starve, right? So, aggressiveness is not something bad in itself, but it has been shaped by original sin. Name at least.
Excuse me, Father. Are you saying then that I'm a little confused. I'm thinking that the personality in itself is positive. It's the character that has the negative quality. Is that right?
Well, not quite. Not quite, brother. Because, see, we are conceived with a fallen human nature. Now it's true, and you're touching on mystery and I won't solve it. It's true that the soul as God creates it is good. But, and this is the best we can do, the moment that soul is infused into a human body, and that's from the first moment of conception, that soul is already infected by a weakness, sinful tendencies. So, as you might see, humiliating as it may sound, we are conceived and born with sinful personalities. Personalities that have a tendency towards sin, which is what makes Christ and His grace so indispensable. Without Him, you just don't master this fallen nature. Does that help a little bit? Now, could somebody mention one or two of the capital sins, which I call the four capital sinful tendencies, that reflect an aggressive personality?
Pride.
Please?
Pride.
Another?
Envy.
Another?
Slow.
Please?
Anger.
What did you say?
Anger.
Anger. And strangely, somebody said sloth.
Yeah.
You're right. You are so right. In other words, part of our human tendency is to not move, whether physically or even spiritually. And laziness is the sinful unwillingness to move when I should. Okay. Is it what?
Did you not answer four tendencies that are...
Reflect an aggressive personality.
And slow to regret...
Would... Now, as I say, it's the last thing you would expect, right? You would think it's just the opposite. But it can be. Number three. The aggressive personality is not inherently bad. In other words, we don't begin by assuming that the person, because he or she has this tendency, is necessarily bad. Fourth, this personality is typical of all leaders in society and the church. If you want to meet an aggressive personality, meet Mother Teresa. Is she ever aggressive? Beautiful self-control, but as sharp as a whip and as fast as a bullet when action has to be taken.
Excuse me, Father, but I'm sort of confused now, because I would think, you know, if one is sort of very aggressive, it takes, they work more on the human level rather than the spiritual.
Well, I would say.
You know, I'm only asking that as a question. I'm not making it as a statement.
They may, but they don't need not. In other words, as we'll see before this thing is finished, everything with the aggressive personality depends on their having a purpose. And the purpose cannot be self-advantage, self-satisfaction. So that the saints, well, I've got them, I've got six here and I could have added 60. David, a man more than once said, specially beloved of Yahweh, a very aggressive personality. John the Baptist, my patron saint, a very aggressive personality. Peter. Now Christ, who as God had made Peter's soul, knew what was in him. And Christ made sure he had that kind of a soul. When Peter's mother conceived him, the soul that God infused into that body was the soul of an aggressive personality. He was always taking charge. Sometimes when he should and sometimes when he shouldn't. Paul. What an aggressive personality was Paul. The founders and foundresses of religious institutes, right? Now they have the failings or the weaknesses because they're human beings, but they have aggressive personalities. They meet opposition, they meet difficulty. You don't overcome opposition or difficulty unless you have an aggressive personality. Then, take a woman like Teresa of Avila or Mother Cabrini. Talk about aggressiveness. You don't found a community. You don't establish institutes. You don't travel, I don't know how many times, between Rome and the United States as Mother Cabrini did. I've quoted this to some of you. one famous passage of Leo the 13th as she was leaving back for the United States from Rome. Cabrini's parting message was, "Let's love God with the sweat of our brows." I like that kind of mysticism. Sweaty. Fifth, an aggressive personality has a capacity for deep sin or of great holiness. One at a time. Brother.
I would think that, my opinion, I would think, Father, that all of us have to have an element of aggression in the spiritual life.
Have to have a?
An element of positive aggression in the spiritual life.
Yes.
I think most of the saints, I think all the saints, made up their mind that they were going to become a saint.
They really did. Mm-hmm. They really did. And nobody, not the devil himself, would stop them. Okay. You're right. Okay. Number six. Absolutely necessary for achievement. Because the unaggressive, the pliant personality, once it meets opposition or difficulty, well, says this must be the will of God. Well, maybe it is, but maybe it isn't. Find out. Whether this is an obstacle or an opportunity. Whether it's an obstacle to be overcome or an opportunity for humiliation. But first make sure. Now, how to deal with first, I recommend, which we have to do for ourselves, is help the person recognize that they have, if they have, this trait. Now, some people, and this will surprise you, some people give the very opposite impression. They can be very aggressive, but they don't leave that impression on you, maybe even on themselves. There is positive aggression, there is negative aggression. So first to recognize what kind of person they are. Secondly, have the person understand the particular kind of aggressive personality they have, whether it is, first, an aggressive personality that shows itself by domination of others for self. Right? See, there's nothing wrong with commanding others, correct? There better not be, otherwise that would be the end of religious life. Somebody's got to be in charge. It's first to find out whether I'm trying to dominate. Now, the word dominate already has the bad connotation. Whether I'm trying to, you might say, command or rule over the others for my own advantage. Now, some people have, and this is what we're talking, I'm talking about the persons who have the natural capacity to command. It's a great gift. Do you know that? It's a great gift. But must be controlled. So that, and they have to be mortified and humiliated in order to get over their tendency to selfishly dominate or rule over other people. Secondly, make sure that they recognize that this faculty, and it's a faculty, is used to achieve things for God. Now I can speak, as by now you must have gathered, rather comfortably about this personality. I'm very familiar with it. It may take years. It does take years of training. But that the capacity to rule, to command, to direct is never for my own advantage. And that means a lot of humiliation, because this personality tends to dominate and has to watch itself.
Father, I would, from my experience, I think that a lot of the young people coming into religious life today have an element of this aggressiveness because of the fact that the world is very competitive. And I think you observe this, I observe this very much more today. I think a lot of the young people have that element of aggression because the world tends to be competitive.
And this, I think, is, by the way, by now from last year, I must have spoken who knows how many hours on these subjects dealing with formation. I consider what we're talking about here one of the most important in the 2 years. You're right, brother. Thanks for raising it. Because as the young people or not so young come in, and we have the image of what a religious should be, they may frighten us, they may threaten us, you know what I mean? It seems, well, what religious life is for docile souls, for the gentle, for the submissive, for those who surrender their wills. That's true. You're right, brother. And I think that is one reason why in dealing with formation now, one reason that I put this in. Because I think most people that have even survived the world long enough to enter the religious life. Don't you think so?
I don't think we can depend as much as we could on docility with people entering religious life. I think they have been conditioned.
Oh, brother, this is, you have no idea how important this is. And the reason is because, of course, docility must be there. But the docility is what it should be. It's for the mind, that the mind is enlightened. That they know and are taught, and it takes time, that they will submit in certain things and in other things. Well, I'm teaching novices, for example. Well, in a half an hour, we'll have some novices here in class. But I teach Mother Claudia's novices, for example, in Philadelphia. 2 days. This is Saturday. Monday and Tuesday of this week. Delightful women. Very pleasant. I've taught them for, it's my 7th year. And I've taught novices from way back when. They are outspoken. They tell me things. For example, I think I mentioned this to you a couple of years ago with a group of novices, and I noticed one novice regularly reading a book during my class. I've thought to myself, now Jesuit scholastics, I would expect this, but not sisters. So I couldn't stand it anymore. I said, sister, and I was a little irritated, would you tell us what book you're reading? So she did. She said, yes, I'm reading the dictionary to keep up with your vocabulary. Good for me to hear. From then on, we always make sure there's a dictionary in the room. Right? That's just the way they think. So, it is necessary for achievement of the spiritual life, and I would say many nowadays come, and maybe most of them, come with their aggressiveness more developed, almost necessarily, than it had been even a dozen years ago. Now, third, these are recommendations. Must be balanced by humility and charity. Those are the two virtues that from my novitiate days on, because I was told I had to work on them, and so I am doing it. And you can't let up. That means you deliberately do things that other people perhaps wouldn't have to do, that are more, well, more simple, less obtrusive, less publicly recognized. I'll never forget when good sister Gorgonia, fourth grade, I remember almost the time of the day, whatever I was doing in the back of the room, and she called out about 60 of us, and she said, "Johnny, stop showing off." Right? I took it to heart. We've got to practice humility. In other words, that this kind of personality must be given opportunity to do things that don't let the person shine, right? Otherwise, you will not be helping this kind of individual to cope with their personality. And the same with charity. The built-in tendency of aggressive people is to be aggressive for their own advantage. So, let them practice charity so that their aggressiveness will be, shall we say, spent on a good cause. So that it's for the kingdom, for Christ, for souls. And not for themselves. My clock says 1:45, and for a rare change, suppose we end on time. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death, amen. O Mary, conceived without sin,
pray for us who have recourse to thee.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Our first class, therefore, is on the theology of the vows. You'll go for something inside of an hour, take a break, and then continue until 1:00. At a meeting that I had yesterday in New York City, I understand the Code of Canon Law is definitely finished, has been gone over by the bishops of the Catholic Church twice, and is now in the hands of the Holy Father, has been read by him, and except for some final touches, should be out, so all reports indicate, sometime in maybe early 81. I understand some of the bishops had a meeting with Cardinal Felici, who was the director of the Commission for the Revision of the Code, with the Holy Father in the meeting, asked him whether they would have another chance, the bishops, to go over the text of the Code of Canon Law. And he said, as far as I know, not. And they began to argue with Cardinal Felici, the bishops. And finally, after some moments or minutes of arguing, he said, "Don't blame me, blame him," pointing to the Holy Father. And the Pope shook his head, "No, there will be no more revisions by the bishops." Good to hear, isn't it? Father Baker, who told me that last night at a meeting we had, at a meeting that he had with various people during the Synod. Consequently, what we are saying now is as of the code today. What developments will be reflected in the forthcoming code, right now only the Holy Father knows, because he is reserving to himself the final draft. I don't expect any dramatic, certainly not traumatic, changes. Nevertheless, it's good to know where we are today. There are, in general, three kinds of institutes of Christian perfection, and that, by the way, is the best generic term to cover every form of living the evangelical counsels. Institutes of Christian perfection. The first is the religious state. And maybe I should put the word state there. The second is the so-called societies of common life, and the third are secular institutes. First, a word about religious institutes in general. The word itself is derived from the Latin religio, which is the virtue of justice practiced towards God. That, I think, is the best theological definition of religion. It is the virtue of justice practiced towards God. Justice, in general, is the virtue that gives another person his due. It recognizes and lives up to the rights that someone has. In this case, the one who has the rights is God. As I recognize those rights mentally, put them into practice volitionally, I practice the virtue of religion. First, a general definition of a religious institute of whatever form. The definition occurs in Canon 488, and it reads, it's a little long, but it's worth it. It is a society approved by legitimate ecclesiastical authority. A society approved by legitimate ecclesiastical authority whose members strive after evangelical perfection, whose members strive after evangelical perfection according to the laws proper to their society, according to the laws proper to their society, by the profession of public vows, by the profession of public vows, either perpetual or temporary, the latter, that is temporary, vows, the latter to be renewed after fixed intervals of time. Let me read the Church's official definition of a religious institute. It is a society approved by legitimate ecclesiastical authority, whose members strive after evangelical perfection, according to the laws proper to their society, by the profession of public vows, either perpetual or temporary, the latter to be renewed after fixed intervals of time. you will notice there is nothing there about apostolic work, is there? The essence of religious life is to strive after perfection. Let's take each part and spend a moment or two. It is first of all, then, a society, which means it is a body of persons striving after a common purpose by using the same means under the direction of legitimate authority. So first it's a society with physical persons who strive after a common purpose or goal and use the same means under the direction of legitimate authority. Second, this society must be approved by legitimate ecclesiastical authority. That's why a new community cannot begin unless or until ecclesiastical authority authorizes the creation of this new society. Third, it must have laws that are proper to that society, implying that each religious institute will have different laws because it has a different purpose. For example, in the society to which I belong, we call ourselves the Society of Jesus. Among our rules is to travel to various places wherever there is hope of God's greater glory and the good of souls. I think coming to Chicago fosters God's greater glory and is for the good of, frankly, your souls. I comfort myself with a thought. Well then, we have laws that are different from other societies. I may travel. Others may not travel. Some must stay put. Again, fourth, the vows are to be public vows, which, as we've seen, perhaps, are those accepted in the name of the Church by a legitimate ecclesiastical superior. The two elements that constitute a public vow. First, they are accepted in the name of the Church, and second, by a person who is in legitimate authority and is authorized to thus accept them. Fourth or fifth, these public vows, this may surprise you, may be either perpetual or temporary. May I ask, can we have a full-fledged and authentic religious community in which the members all take temporary vows?
Yes.
Yes. But they must renew those vows at fixed intervals provided by their constitutions. All right? That's the general definition of a religious institute. There are, in general, in the present canon law of the Church, three kinds of religious institutes. First, there is a religious order. A religious order is one in which solemn vows are taken. A congregation is one in which only simple vows are taken. Note the adverb, only simple vows are taken. Because in the Society of Jesus, we may take either simple or solemn vows. And yet we are in order, although most of our members do not take solemn vows. Third, there is a monastic congregation. What's a monastic congregation? It's really a confederation or reunion of a number of independent monasteries . Thus, the monasteries of the Order of Saint Benedict are united into 15 congregations. Father Downey, is that about, that's what my source tells me, 15 monastic congregations of Benedictines in the Church?
Worldwide?
Worldwide. Two of which, there are others I'm told, but two of which are the American Cassinese and the Swiss American. Which one is yours, Father?
American Cassinese.
American Cassinese. They include most of the Benedictine institutes in America. The Swiss American and the American Cassinese. Right? Now, given the three categories, we have two kinds of, in both classes, we have exempt institutes, which are either institutes under solemn vows, or maybe communities under simple vows. Congregations, for example, although they have simple vows, may nevertheless be exempt. So do not assume or identify exemption with taking solemn vows. Communities that are congregations may nevertheless be exempt. All under solemn vows are also exempt. In other words, those under solemn vows are by definition exempt. But those under simple vows may either be exempt or not. Now, an exempt institute is withdrawn from the jurisdiction of the local ordinary. Withdrawn from the jurisdiction of the local ordinary or bishop. The degree of exemption depends on many factors. I think it is better to look at it this way before we go into the next distinction between a pontifical and a diocesan institute. Lest we simply identify all pontifical institutes as exempt and all diocesan as not exempt. That doesn't strictly follow. Exemption per se means withdrawal from the jurisdiction of the local bishop. There are degrees of exemption. Diocesan communities can be more or less exempt. Pontifical institutes are all exempt, but again, there are degrees of exemption. Brother.
Exempt meaning the internal affairs of the institute. Does that mean?
No. That's autonomy, which, because you said it, I will now briefly explain it. All religious institutes of whatever category are autonomous. Once, whether diocesan or pontifical, they are set up canonically as a religious institute. By that fact, they enjoy autonomy. Autonomy has to do with the internal affairs of the institute to be and remain themselves. Autonomy, therefore, means the right to be and remain yourself. And by right, that means the freedom, always, of course, under the Church's laws. Right means the freedom to either be or do something. All religious institutes enjoy autonomy for their internal life and purpose of their existence. Brother, you had your hand up.
Excuse me, Father, but I presume I'm wrong.
Please?
Even though I'm going to ask it. I understood autonomy to mean, in the monastic sense of that term, it meant when a foundation was made, it meant that that the new monastery, wherever it was made, was not an autonomous monastery, purely because it relied on the mother monastery for financial and support and so forth.
Well, there is another term coined for that, and that is, that kind of a monastery is dependent. So we now have, and the more questions you ask, the more terms we'll come up with.
I'm sorry for the red herring.
Well, in the monastic sense, there are two kinds of monasteries, dependent and independent.
Yes.
Dependent monasteries are not, if you wish, autonomous, in that unique sense that they depend on the parent or mother monastery for financial support and a certain amount of, well, obedience to the, say, chief abbot. But autonomy is a totally different term. Autonomy refers to an institute as institute to be and remain itself. And autonomy is a form of independence, but it is independence, well, I would say, of everyone, including, say, the bishop. No one, by church law, has a right to interfere with the autonomy of an institute that wants to be whatever the church said it may be. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Now, a pontifical institute is one which has been so approved by the church. Until a few years ago, it used to be a community that received the so-called decree of praise, Decretum Laudis. That has been changed in the last several years. There's quite a description of that in a recent issue of Consecrated Life. It's more formal, and I would say also more definite. At any rate, it is a special approbation by the Holy See. One term which the Church now uses for a pontifical institute is to say it is reached ecclesiastical maturity. In other words, the Church's desire now is that all institutes do finally become pontifical. Now that's a large statement, because many bishops don't have the same idea. Most of the sisters in New York City to this day belong to diocesan institutes. Communities of 500-600 are still, after a century, diocesan, because one Cardinal Archbishop of New York after another, quite frankly, did not want to let go the kind of authority which bishops do exercise over diocesan institutes, mainly to keep them in his diocese. Then, conversely, a diocesan institute is one erected by a local ordinary. Note the difference? See, not all institutes were originally founded by a local bishop. name three religious institutes in the history of the church that were more certainly not founded by the local ordinary. Sister? Please?
Our own institute.
Was not founded?
Founded by the local ordinary, founded by our founder.
By founded by?
Our founder.
Well, sister, thanks for saying that, because all institutes are founded by, well, the founder. Now, if I said founded, I should have used the word established, erected by a local ordinary. Did I use the verb founded?
Yes.
Did I?
Yes.
Well, they are founded. See, I'm dealing with professionals who have become so accustomed to the vocabulary, I've got to be very careful. So, the founder is, of course, the one who, well, starts, who gets the inspiration. His or her spirit, then, animates those who follow the founder. But the establishment comes from ecclesiastical authority. Now, that can be either, and generally is, the local bishop, or the pope, or in one extraordinary case, a general council. Now, the Franciscans were not founded by a local ordinary. Father Donnie, who would you say established the Benedictines, assuming Saint Benedict?
Well, it's not at all clear, Father.
Would you say it's a local ordinary?
Again, it's not clear. There's Cardinal Schuster speculates that it possibly was founded by the Pope.
By the Pope. That is what I have been teaching. You see, I am sure regarding the Society of Jesus that it was established by the Council of Trent. Of course, the Pope, but with the Council of Trent. A Franciscan, St. Francis, went to the Pope. Right? So, a diocesan institute is one that has both been established or erected, not to use the word founded, by the local bishop, and remains under his jurisdiction and has not been established or reestablished as if a pontifical institute, or the technical term is an institute of pontifical right, R-I-G-H-T. Now, the Daughters of St. Mary of Providence are, Sister Agnes, are you a community of a pontifical right or of diocesan right?
Pontifical.
Okay. But you were originally of diocesan right, originally. Then after some time, you reached maturity, as the expression goes, and became an institute of pontifical right. Any questions before we go on? Yes, Brother?
Father, as a matter of fact, is it not that the church has to be present in some form for the erection of the institute, either local or pontifical, whatever. The church has to be present as a symbol of the authenticity of the erection of that institute, correct?
That's right. In other words, even the great Saint Francis, one of the church's greatest mystics, wrote a rule, if you know, he wrote a rule which was not approved. Remember? It caused much division afterwards in the Franciscans. The Pope insisted on a revision, and if you please, a modification, that is a, I suppose, an alleviation. It was so strict, so austere, simple, but total, destitute poverty. And then St. Francis gave in to the Pope, and There is no institute in existence until ecclesiastical authority says you exist. No saint, even the seven founders of the Servites, right? That's a lot of saints to found an order. Even seven of them. That's not enough to constitute a religious institute. The church must step in. It's her authority that creates the institute. It is her authority that keeps the institute in existence. It is her authority that dissolves institutes. And not the sanctity or charism of the founder. And not all bishops who approve religious institutes are saints. As for that matter, not all popes have been saints. You know that, don't you? Any other questions? So is the church's authority, whether saintly or not, that constitutes, and this is the faith of the Catholic Church, and she, the church, has a right to determine whether the constitutions deserve approval. If they deserve approval, then that community is authentic. That's why, and it's the main reason, why, as I've told more than one audience, a minimum of 50, I would estimate up to 100 institutes in the United States will disappear by the year 2000. And this is not a prophetic insight, it's just a statement of fact. They can't make it, barring what I'd like to see take place, a miracle. And one reason is, for years now, they have been operating on constitutions that no ecclesiastical authority has approved, except they approve themselves.
In a recent meeting of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, on their agenda was a statement to the effect that they would no longer submit their constitution to Rome, but approve their own constitution by a peer commission, which would give no ecclesiastical substance to the very constitutions which they have.
Well, that's why they're going out of existence. And this is one reason why what has scandalized so many people, what seems to be the apathy of Rome. But as one who works for the Holy See, I assure you, it's not apathy. It is a recognition of a fact. Things are dying, institutes are going to disappear, and, well, the Holy See, could the popes have done more? Could the present pope be more emphatic, more clear or explicit as to what religious life should be? He couldn't be. But there must be enough faith to want to submit to that authority. Without that submission, there is no religious institute has hope of survival. Individuals, because of their faith, will retain both their vows and commitment, and will be sanctified in the process. But as communities, they will disappear. As historically, I've told you this, I'm sure, especially last year, historically most of the institutes in the now about 16 centuries of organized religious life have de facto disappeared. It is that authority which establishes and maintains in existence brochures, books, publications, banners, to the contrary notwithstanding. It's that authority that constitutes an institute in its existence and maintains it. Now, yes, Father?
Take this up later, this question, I'll skip it, but I'm interested in knowing, for instance, when the bishop establishes an institute, his establishment has to be approved by the sacred congregation of rites,
yes,
rules and constitutions and everything. He doesn't make them up and they
that's right.
go along on that. It all has to go to the sacred congregation.
And this is one reason, historically, why so many communities had such short-lived existences. Because for centuries, that's what was going on. There were communities coming into diocesan existence with the approval of the local ordinary, and the Holy See didn't even know they existed. But, and this is for some time now, the Church's law is, as you said, Father, even to begin, in other words, the Holy See must give the approval to the bishop. He cannot act independent of Rome.
Just one more step backwards, I would say, but in the beginning, now you have a group of women or men who want to live this together in a common life. They approach the bishop for his approval. He can give approval to their beginning. In other words, they don't have to wait to begin until they get something back from the sacred congregation.
He can. Although, now we could go through all the regulations under which the bishop must act. They're pretty strict, though. In other words, he shouldn't proceed too far, but he may not. Now, if he does, he's acting arbitrarily without informing the Holy See, I would say, almost from the beginning. Yes.
So then what happens to, if the church decides to write off a congregation, no longer approve it for whatever reason, they decide to remove their approval of that institute. The people who have vowed themselves to that institute have vowed, sometimes they take perpetual vows of life. What happens to those people?
Well, it depends on the nature of the suppression. Now here's where the Jesuits are very well informed, because we were suppressed. And pray, by the way, because the Holy Father is, and I have to say this publicly, unhappy with the Society of Jesus. And it's some 3 years ago that our general spoke of the risk of another suppression. Now when we were suppressed in the 18th century, some 25,000 Jesuits. It was the most absolute suppression of the Church's history. From a certain date, all simply became, if they were ordained, diocesan priests, and if they were not ordained, became lay people. And even though their vows were perpetual and solemn, they were all dissolved. Now that was the price that the heads of several European states, France, Spain, and Portugal, demanded of Rome. Otherwise they were going to secede and take their countries away from the Church. You must suppress the Jesuits absolutely. And the reason was, we were such strong defenders of the papacy. Would to God we were that today. That they said to themselves, we can't cope. We cannot control the Church as long as the Jesuits are in existence. And they were right. The Pope, who wrote the document of suppression, died of a broken heart soon after. And our general, this is some years ago, when the 40-volume Lives of the Popes, which I commend to your reading, during my theology to keep myself busy, besides studying, I read the 40 volumes once, and I started over again. By the time I finished theology, I finished volume 23. But in the Lives of the Popes, four of those volumes of the 40, deal with the conflict between, well, the civil powers and the Society of Jesus, and the Pope suppressing the Jesuits. One of our recent generals, when this work, which is originally in German, was being published in English, he forbade any Jesuit in the world to review the volumes dealing with the suppression of the Jesuits, because it showed how the Pope caved in to the authority of the civil powers. Now, before God, he felt he was doing the right thing to save the Church. At any rate, 40 years later, we were brought back into existence, and every year we celebrate, we have to say a Mass, first intention, to thank God, first, for our being founded, and then another, for our being reestablished. We have two birthdays.
When you reestablished, who was there left, or who was there to do the reestablishing? The people, the diocesan priest had been Jesuit priest, or who made it up?
Well, what happened during the 40 years, a group of Jesuits was working in Russia, and the then Empress was Catherine the Great. She was Orthodox, that is, Eastern Orthodox, and did not recognize the authority of the Pope. So when the decree of suppression came out, she said, well, that's only for those who obey the Pope, but not for me. That's Catherine. So the Jesuits, who lived in Russia, had, of course, a qualm of conscience. Our greatest act of obedience as Jesuits was when we obeyed the Pope, allowing ourselves to be suppressed. Not one Jesuit rebelled. Isn't that beautiful? Took our, you might say, dissolution in obedience. In the process, 2,000 of our men died in prison because they were imprisoned by the civil authorities. Catherine refused to obey the Pope. The Jesuits in Russia wrote to the Pope and said, now, Holy Father,